right, 1 Kings chapter 11. You can tell by our title that things are not going as well in chapter 11. We've had hints at Solomon's mind and heart being divided, being drawn towards other things. And now we have a full-fledged, and this is really, I've got to slide elsewhere, but it's kind of a literary punch in the face, sort of, you know? It's like all of a sudden, it really takes a turn and goes downhill. Should probably get to the right chapter. I'm going to read it. All right. So, chapter 11 is the final assessment of Solomon by the author of 1 Kings. So this is the last time we're going to hear about Solomon. Obviously, we're going to divide this chapter up a little bit more. But this chapter is the last of Solomon. And unlike the earlier chapters that we've got about, in this account, lays bare the faults and frailties of, you know, a guy that was brilliant, a guy that was full of wisdom, a guy that did amazing things and took... it took Israel to heights of prosperity that they had not seen, probably because of his father as well. But then all of a sudden we do not have a good picture of him in verse 11 or chapter 11. And it seems to be about the last 10 years of his reign. It says in his old age things take a turn, and the failures are obviously going to affect him, but they're going to affect the nation of Israel even more. So this is a big chapter on the turn towards exile. I mean, that's really the road we're exiting the highway of prosperity and heading toward exile now after chapter 11. So there's four episodes in this. We're only going to cover the first one today. So we've got Solomon's idolatry. Then we're going to have several rebellions that rise up against Solomon. We'll have a prophecy and then Solomon's death in this chapter. So those are our four episodes. So the justice of God is on display here, and he has warned the Israelites and Solomon over and over and over again what would happen, blessings versus cursings, if they were depending on following the law. So covenant faithfulness would have allowed the covenant people blessing and safety, but their disobedience leaves a just God no alternative except to punish him. It's, again, the whole idea of how we mess up this concept of fairness versus justice. You know, we do not want a fair God, we want a just God. Speaking of fairness, some of y'all might have seen the article this week. I did a podcast on Friday. But there's some philosophers. That's their job title. I wonder how you get that job. But and it came out of Australia, so maybe you'd be a philosopher in Australia. But they were doing a social study on unfairness in society. And if you read to your kids at bedtime, you're not doing good things for them, you're creating a system of unfairness for kids that don't get read to at bedtime. So you should really reconsider. Yeah. And private schooling is just out of the question. You can't do that because not everybody can do that. So you're really creating a climate of unfairness when you do those sorts of things. So it's one of those studies where it's kind of a duh thing. It's like the most profound truth. Oh, you mean families that actually love their kids and invest in their kids, they actually do better? Wow, thanks for pointing that out to us. But then you approach it from that angle. It's just, that's what the world has done to it. In the struggle for fairness, that's what we're talking about. And I mean, they're talking about legitimately, like it's a real thing, you know? Yeah, it is, isn't it? Exactly. Yeah. Because we can't possibly get everybody up, so we got to pull everybody down. Yeah. Embrace mediocrity, and you know, just
somebody on Facebook, and I never go on Facebook, but I was on it once, and somebody who maybe it was somebody in this room posted something from John Wayne, a quote from him.
Yeah.
He said, "Life is tough. It's really hard though if you're stupid." Yeah. And I'm thinking, who would think along these lines? People must be idiots.
Yeah, I've seen the. Yeah, I've seen the one where it's you know, give a man a fish and he can eat for a day, teach a man to fish. Actually, don't teach a man to fish because it's not that hard. Can't figure that out. You're not gonna make it in life. So that's fairness. That's what our culture loves, fairness. But from a biblical perspective, fairness means, I mean, think about it, from a fairness perspective from God, that means either everybody goes to hell or everybody goes to heaven. That would be fair as far as God is concerned. He is just. He is not fair. You know, I tell kids all the time, it's like, you know, it's not fair. Look around the room. None of us look the same. None of us have the same attributes. We all have different talents. We all have different abilities. That's not fair. Okay? You know, some of y'all had dreams of dunking basketballs one day, and you're not. It's not fair. Okay? I'm sorry. Like I said, maybe I wanted to be a jockey in the Kentucky Derby. Never going to happen. It's not fair. You got a visual picture now, don't you? And a very uncomfortable horse, apparently. Not good, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, I'd be running it like a kid on a tricycle. As far as Solomon goes here, this is a just God. And God said, if you will obey my commands, you'll get blessings. If you don't obey my commands, there's going to be consequences. And now Solomon falls into sin, and God is just, and he does what he says he's going to do. And so we're going to see consequences. So Solomon said to man, begun small, you know, get some horses over here, get some more gold over here, get this, expand my territory, build some fortresses, get some more chariots, little things like that. And all of a sudden he wakes up one day and he's got 700 wives. I mean, and 300 concubines. Yeah, we'll get that too. So when his sin begins to grow, maybe it happens overnight. Maybe it's just a gradual thing. Whatever it is, it gets to really unhealthy proportions in chapter 11. And it's a national disintegration that was at times slow but never completely halted. Once Solomon goes into this sin, Israel's on a downward slide. And there are small little pockets of kings, and we'll cover those sometimes. You know, you'll have a Hezekiah or a Josiah that pop up and kind of right the ship for a little while, and then you start going right back downhill again. There's just not enough opposition to the sin that's coming in. So I think the thing here is, as goes the king, so goes the nation. Or as goes the president, so goes the nation. Or as goes the father, so goes the family. You know, I mean, you can put it, as goes the principal, so goes the school, the pastor and the church. You can put that, whatever kind of analogy you want in there. And if the leadership falls, the organization tends to follow. Okay, it's almost unavoidable.
Qualifying for the cedar that's fallen.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's, you know, the head of the snake, as it were. I mean, you know, it goes, it follows that head. So, and sometimes you can recover, and sometimes you can't. So, like I said, whatever's on your mind this morning, put that in that analogy. If you're in a leadership position, then you're the king in this analogy somewhere. Whatever your leadership position is. So, I think it's something to consider. All right, let's look at our text. First 8 verses of the text. This is, now King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh. We knew about her. Remember, he built her a whole palace and everything several chapters ago. Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the people of Israel, you shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they with you. For surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. Solomon clung to these in love. He had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines. And his wives turned away his heart. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods. And his heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. So Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and did not wholly follow the Lord as David his father had done. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and for Molech, the abomination of the Ammonites, on the mountain east of Jerusalem. And so he did for all his foreign wives who made offerings and sacrificed to their gods. So we got a lot of foreign women and a lot of foreign gods.
Is that the Mount of Olives?
It is the Mount of Olives, yes. I'll have a picture so you can kind of visualize that in a little bit. So, very specific about what was going on here, about how many wives, about all this. And again, God warned them way back with Moses. If you intermarry, there's going to be problems. It's the reason why God said you need to clear out the land of the Canaanites. Because if you let them hang around, they're going to be a snare to you, because you're going to start marrying their daughters, and they're going to start marrying your sons, and all of a sudden you're going to go astray. God told them what was going to happen. The Israelites don't clear out the foreigners, and look what happens. They are the snare that he promised. Okay, so Solomon's idolatry, like I said, it's a question of faith. Okay? Okay? It's like George McFly and Biff. So because everything was great in chapter 10, we got gold, 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 money, money, money. And now all of a sudden, Solomon had many foreign wives. So obviously Solomon's weakness was women. Very clearly, that's what he, and I think gold in the last chapter, we could tell he liked money too. But obviously women is one of his weaknesses. So 700 wives and 300 concubines. Like the earlier marriage to Pharaoh's daughter, most of these unions were probably politically motivated. You know, you go make peace with the neighboring kingdom. And so he is doing, from a political perspective, it's a brilliant move. Right? From a worldly, secular perspective, he's making alliances and it's great. But from a godly perspective, he's totally disobeying what God told him to do. Because this is what we'll see in 1 Kings, and if you read 2 Kings, it's the same thing, is these kings keep making alliances and stuff, and God's like, you really just need to trust in me. Like, I will protect you. No, we got to make an alliance with Egypt. We got to make an alliance with Syria. We've got to do this. We've got to do that. And God just kind of sits back and goes, you know, you could have been safe. You know, I could have taken care of you, and you were trusting in men and horses and chariots. And this is what's leading to your downfall. So, again, from a political perspective, any pagan kingdom would have situations like this. You'd have many, many wives because you needed to make peace with your neighboring nations, potential war and all that kind of stuff. Or if somebody attacks you, now you've got people to come to your aid and all that. But from a biblical perspective, obviously, Solomon has messed up 700 times over.
Isn't the New Testament principle here not to be unequally yoked?
Yeah, I think it's exactly how it's...
You can look at what happened to him and say, hey, this is likely the kind of same kind of scenario for you if you married unbelievers.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, the snare is there. And I mean, you know, you don't have idols in the living room, but at the same time, you can absolutely get pulled away.
And if nobody minds me saying this, it does also, for women, this is a problem that we have with men that don't do what they're supposed to do. It's because then women get used as chattel, or a bargaining chip, or
you're going to have to flesh that out.
Yeah, I'm just saying, I have a wonderful husband, so I can say that with all confidence. But it just makes women, because this is what men do.
On the other side, too, I'm sure many of these women went willingly, like, ooh, I need to be with the king, you know what I mean? But really, they should be.
Yeah, well, the thing that makes it especially shocking with Solomon is he knows better. You know, when the whole thing with Tiger Woods came out, you remember that story a few years back? You know, and everybody's like, I can't believe he would do that. Like I said, I absolutely believe he could do that. He's an unbeliever with $1 billion, and he has more power and recognition than anything else. If I was that guy, I'd do it exactly what he did. You know, I mean, why would I expect him not to do that? You know, I mean, that's exactly what I expect an unbeliever with unlimited money, unlimited resources, unlimited access to whatever he wants to do. I mean, it's Solomon. I mean, that's who he was, except without God anywhere in the picture. So we shouldn't be shocked when unbelievers act like unbelievers. You know, I think that's... But Solomon is different. You know, he knows. He has spoken to God, literally, spoken to God 3 times. So he knows better than this. Okay? So he disobeyed Moses' law for marriage. You might as well throw the contract away. Because it's a clear breach of covenant, and Solomon has talked with God 3 different times, chapter 3, chapter 6, chapter 9, and every time God said, if you'll walk like your father did, I'll bless you. And if you don't, consequences are coming, right from God's mouth, and he still disobeys. So God was very clear to Moses as well. If we go back to Deuteronomy 7, he said, you shall not intermarry with them, giving your daughters to their sons, or taking their daughters for your sons, for they would turn away your sons from following me to serve other gods. Almost prophetic. Then the anger of the Lord would be kindled against you, and he would destroy you quickly. This is a big deal to God. Idolatry is a big deal. In Exodus 34, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and when they whore after their gods and sacrifice to their gods, and you are invited, you eat of his sacrifice, you take of their daughters for your sons, and their daughters whore after their gods, and make your sons whore after their gods. Pretty clear language there, right? Okay. So there you go. Bad things happen when you intermarry. Hey, Solomon has broken Moses' law for kings. Now, we've referenced this several times already in reference to gold and horses and all that kind of stuff. But if we look at Deuteronomy 17, I keep skipping over it as I flip my pages. See, this is his instructions to them. We've got it up there, too. He says, when you come to the land that the Lord your God is giving you, and you possess it and dwell in it, and then say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me. You may indeed set a king over you whom the Lord your God will choose. One from among your brothers you shall set as a king over you. You may not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother. Only he must not acquire many horses of himself. He did that already. Or cause the people to return to Egypt. He did that already in order to acquire many horses. Since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return that way again. And he shall not acquire many wives for himself. Well, he's done that. Lest his heart turn away. That's what happened. Nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold. We covered that last chapter. 11 times gold mentioned in the last chapter. And when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of this law approved by the Levitical priests. And it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by keeping all the words of this law and these statutes and doing them. So I think Solomon used to do that. He's obviously not doing that now. This is the same guy that wrote the Proverbs. This is the same guy that wrote Ecclesiastes. This is that same guy, full of wisdom, and this is what he's doing now. And verse 20, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brothers, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment, either to the right hand or the left, so that he may continue long in his kingdom, he and his children in Israel. So obedience equals long-lasting kingdom. Disobedience, swift judgment. Right, Solomon evidently wants to be like pagan kings. It's like he's fallen into the trap. He looked around and everybody else has gold and everybody else has wives. And, that whole thing when Israel did the same thing when they wanted Saul, we need a king. And God said, you really don't need a king. You got me. Yeah, we know God. We got you. But we really want a king. Why do you want a king? Because everybody else has a king. And before we get too judgmental, just think back to like your teenage years and how many times you thought that exact same thing. Everybody else gets to do that, or maybe even older than that, but that was weird. So Moses knows that kings who become too wealthy and powerful begin to desire possessions and women more than they desire to serve God and the people. Hey, more and more materialism is going to get you more and more focused on the materials. And that's exactly what happens to Solomon. Solomon's forgotten this admonition. He has competed with other kings and queens in wisdom and splendor, and on top of that, he's won. Remember, Queen Sheba comes up, and she's like, this guy's unbelievable. And even she said, God's given you amazing wisdom. Not you're wise, but God's given you amazing wisdom, and your people are blessed because you're here. And so not only does he want to be great, he is great. He is the best. He is the smartest. He does have the most stuff. So the egotistical stuff can really come up very quickly. He is winning. It'd be one thing if he just claimed to be the best, and he was this little rinky-dink kingdom, but he claims to be the best, and he backs it up. Okay? It's not bragging if you back it up. Is that he can back up his words. So even more pride, and I think that's the sin that we're seeing here, obviously. While victories are gifts from God, competing in wives is clearly outside of God's will and promise to bless. So you get the idea that Solomon is chalking up 700 wives to, wow, God's blessing me. That's not how God blesses you. That's a worldly thing. Okay? And 4-8, these verses are particular. They're sickening for us in particular. And imagine a Jew reading this in Babylon or something like that and tracing back, how did we get here? And it would be especially hard to read because not only does he have the numerous wives, but he allows that to corrupt his devotion to God. It allows him to start chasing other gods. And you wonder, how does something like this happen? How does a wise man like Solomon end up worshiping other gods? Well, it says in the text, though, that his heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. And that's going to be the measuring stick from here on out. They do not walk in the steps of David. David walked because he was a man after God's own heart. Doesn't mean David was perfect, but I think what you see with David is even when he messes up, the attitude is one of repentance. It is one of brokenness. I think that's the big difference between David and Saul. If you really wanted to make a chart, you could probably find more David sins than Saul sins. But look at how they react every time they get found out in sin. It's the heart issue there. And so Solomon does not live up to it. He was not a man after God's own heart. His heart no longer wholly belonged to God. He doesn't stop believing in God. He doesn't replace God. He just starts getting divided. I think that's the important thing.
David, if I can point out one thing. I think this is why, for us, for me, it is so easy to follow a very strong pastor like Pastor Sean. I'm just going to give him a little plug. Because he can offend all day long, and does. But everybody, it's very clear that, but it's so clear where his heart is. He is so devoted to God. And at the risk of offending God, he'll offend anybody. He has to please God.
Yeah.
And that is his heart, to please God, not men.
Yeah.
And this is what's happening here.
Man has become more important.
The Lord has ceased to be a major factor in Solomon's life, and once that shift occurs, it's only natural. You are going to chase after something. You are going to be focused on something. So if you move your perspective off of God, whether you realize it or not, you are now chasing something else, and that's exactly what's going to go on in Solomon. Okay? C.S. Lewis said this in The Problem of Pain: the human spirit not even begin to try to surrender self-will as long as all seems to be well with it. And I'm thinking, how well was it in Israel? It couldn't have been any more well. Now, error and sin both have this property, that the deeper they are, the less their victim suspects their existence. They are a mass to evil. And so, sin becomes so ingrained, you don't even realize it's there. The error that he is doing becomes so ingrained, he doesn't even, I don't think he gets up every day and goes, I'm going to worship 4 pagan idols today. But it just becomes natural. Because his wife says, aren't we going to go up to the high place today? Yeah, honey, we'll go up to the high place today. Whatever you want. I don't know how you get there, but he's gotten there. Okay? So it must be the wives' influence. That's what the scripture says. You got 700 people pulling on you in different directions. That might influence you a little bit. But in the ancient world, polytheists tended to worship the gods of nations who had conquered their armies, or at least the gods of countries more powerful than them. So this is really stupid, because Solomon's worshiping gods of nations that he has subdued. What are you doing? It doesn't matter. It'd be one thing if, this is the big Babylonian Empire or the Roman Empire or something, and they are this mighty force, and okay, you guys are doing something right, so I'm going to worship your god. No, he's already beaten all these gods, and now he's worshiping their gods? I mean, you can't be any more backwards than that. There's no, what is the motivation for worshiping these gods? It must be the wives. That's all we can think.
Is that down in the right-hand corner, is that Adam after he got sucked in the apple?
Yeah, probably something like that. Like, I cannot believe this. So the gods we've got here are Ashtoreth. That's the fertility goddess of the Sidonians. And it was like, how appropriate would it be that Solomon chases after a fertility goddess? Because most of those fertility gods and goddesses had sexual practices and stuff that went on with their idol worship. So this guy would be, tempted by that. It's been a stumbling block since the Israelites, since they arrived in Canaan. Judges 2:13 says they abandoned the Lord to serve the Baals and the Ashtaroth. So this goddess has been there forever because they haven't cleared out. Chemosh, underworld god associated with famine, drought, plague, and death. It was called the Abomination of Moab. The name most likely meant destroyer, subduer, or fish god. Josiah finally destroys that cult in Israel in 2 Kings 23. So we're in 1 Kings 11. It's going to be in and around Jerusalem until 2 Kings 23. They're still going to be dealing with it. And then Milcom and Molech, who may be the same god, the abomination of the Ammonites. This is the one that the main thing that comes along with Molech is child sacrifice. Jesus mentions Molech as well, and when he talks about Gehenna, Gehenna was where the Molech worship happened. It was always burning. There was always fires, and they would sacrifice children as a propitiation for their god. And Leviticus 18, it's mentioned way back then. You should not give away any of your children to offer them to Molech. And so profane the name of your God, and I am the Lord. So that's a particularly horrible cult. So if he's caught up with Molech, it doesn't get much worse than that. That's about as bad as it gets with child sacrifice. So we don't have a whole lot of time, but I can get you the map anyway here. Let's see. Yeah. So here's, it's not a great thing, but here's the Temple Mount up here. Okay, so this is west, this is east, kind of running this way. The Kidron Valley runs over here. The Hinnom Valley is over here on the south and the western part of the city. Somewhere down here was Gehenna and where they did the Molech worship. We don't know exactly. There's some places they think they had it. We didn't really go over on that side too much. But down here in the Hinnom Valley is where they would go outside the city. And like I said, that becomes the trash dump in Jesus' day. Gehenna is as dirty and filthy and disgusting as it can get. And that's where a lot of the idol worship took place. During Solomon's day. Does that make sense? Right? And then
It says, then Solomon built a high place on the mountain east of Jerusalem. Okay, and this is the Mount of Olives from the Temple Mount. So if we were standing up on the Temple Mount, down a little bit from the Temple Mount. These are a bunch of tombs that are on the side of the hill, if you get a bigger picture of the Temple Mount. So this is the Mount of Olives. Where is that? That is the Church of All Nations right there. That's where the Garden of Gethsemane is. Okay? And there's garden tombs right over here across the street. So you can come up here and visit. Up here on the far end of the Mount of Olives, that is called the Hill of Corruption or the Hill of Scandal. And that's where Solomon built the high places to the gods. And so you would go up the Mount of Olives and this far end. There's three peaks to the Mount of Olives. Remember, when they say mountain, it doesn't actually mean mountain. It's kind of like Big Hill. It's got some elevation to it, but you wouldn't, if we saw it in America, we wouldn't say, oh, it's a mountain. It would just kind of be a big hill. So when it says mount whatever, it doesn't necessarily mean, don't picture like the Rockies. That's not really what it looks like. So three kind of little points right here. There's some towers up here that you can kind of see from all points of the city. You can see one right down there. There's a university up here today, but right there on the edge. So on the back side of this hill, in view of the temple, in view of God's temple, are high places worshiping pagan gods.
Today?
Not today, but that's where it would have been. That's where it would have been. Yeah, so there's a university on that site now. There's a tower over there. But in that day, you would have been able to see those idol worshiping spots from the very Temple Mount. I mean, that's, talk about brazen, talk about,
it's pretty crazy. Okay.
So we'll kind of end with this idea. What commandment has he broken? I guess you could go with that too. Here's what we've got to understand with these guys in 1st and 2nd Kings. With the exception of Ahab and Jezebel, nobody wants to eliminate Yahweh. This is, Solomon hasn't given up Yahweh worship. He's just worshiping idols in addition. So he's still going to go on the festival days and do all his burnt offerings and everything. So he hasn't removed Yahweh from the equation. He would still consider himself a Yahweh worshiper, believer, a Yahwist, whatever you want to call it. But now he's worshiping other gods too. He's become polytheistic, just like all the other nations. So he has somewhat broken the first commandment, but what he's really broken is the second commandment. He has bowed down to idols, and he has worshipped idols. And I think I've got it up there. That's the next thing. But if we look back at Exodus 20, we can just do it that way because I don't need it on the screen. Look what Exodus 20 says. That's obviously a good chapter to know. let's see. So he says in verse 3, you shall have no other gods before me. Okay. Well, he may not have other gods before God, before Yahweh. Yahweh's still number one. He's just got 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 now. It's supposed to be just one, the Lord your God is one. But look at verse 4. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water in the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. It's really the second commandment that Solomon has a problem with. Because if you asked him, if you put him in, pinned him down and asked him, he would say, no, I still love God. God's number one. Well, yeah, but you're worshiping all these other gods as well. It's the second commandment that he's trashing. You know, the first commandment, he would try to rationalize and say, no, I still, no other gods are before him. You know, he's still number one. But God says here, if you worship idols, we're going to have a problem. Because I'm jealous and I don't put up with that. That's not real worship. Yeah.
Just keep in mind, though, that word, in the Old Testament, the Lord talks about before me.
Yeah, it could be beside.
It could mean beside as well, or in my presence, you
yes.
do not have.
Exactly. Yeah, which he's obviously violating again with the close proximity. Yeah, so it's the thing I want you to make sure you've got a hold of here is these guys aren't forsaking God. They're trying to, they're disrespecting God. They're cheating on God. They're adulterers. That's why that whoring language and all that, that's what's going on. I still got a wife, but I've got 4 girlfriends. Look, I'm still married. What's the big deal? That wouldn't fly. So, and that's not going to fly with God. And that's what Solomon is doing. All right, let's close in prayer.
Father, thank you for today. Thank you for this time in your word. And even though it was a long time ago and we don't deal with necessarily carved idols, there are idols in this world that draw our attention. And I pray that you would help us to be aware of that and deal with the pride that can well up inside of us, no matter what position of leadership we may be in. Help us to feel the responsibility of that and be effective leaders in your strength and in your power and in your name. Be with us as we go. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.